This computer. Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of an Arcot adventure, The Marriage of Serpents. Today's episode, Arkov is a dark world, a dark Bronze Age pre-literate world of magic, mystery, and adventure. And A Marriage of Serpents is an adventure in the dark time after the Gods Fall Wars, where in the Southern Kingdom of Tuhal, we join as our protagonists a group of very unusual magical beings who are getting involved in a seemingly innocuous mystery by the up-and-coming ruler of the Kingdom of Tuhal. Today's episode is episode 8, The Sun. In last week's episode, which was part 2 of The Spiral, our heroes found themselves in perhaps a slightly different a world, perhaps another world, or somehow in the past, or certainly in a slightly different version, but in the kingdom that they left. But in this version, servants or shades of the god of death appear and apparently attack people occasionally. And it was clear that these servants of death were focused on our visitors very specifically. And an ant-like shadow warned them as the white visages of death closed in that they should run before the story got a hold of them. Afterwards, they found themselves in the market and explored and found out that there were, in this Tuhal, there was a secret society called the Yellow Strangers that was fronted by, or perhaps entirely composed of, but was certainly fronted by yellow-haired women who were interested in bringing strangers into their ranks and talking to them of the troubles of the world. Saved or perhaps led astray by a market guard, they managed to make their way out of town and to the environs of the crown, which was much as it was in their Tuhal, except that the yew tree atop the crown, which is an earthwork dome on top of a large buttress of blue granite, the yew tree atop it was of mythic proportions, vast and reaching into the sky. And it was the domain of the new queen of the Kingdom of Tuhal, which had been renamed the Kingdom of the Morning. And they made their way through the castle grounds and up through the ranks of the tree, encountering many unusual talking animals along their way that were either inquisitive, rude, or about their own business. Along the way, they discovered three separate platforms in the tree, one that looked east toward the dawn and the vast storm across the Delafem River, the God's Flood River that borders Tuhal to the east. A platform that looked north into the black confines of Tainwood, from which a chant or a song that seemed to be some kind of summoning, something about rain and sun, something seemed to be continuously emerging. That also seemed to the direction which the speaking ravens that they encountered earlier were concerned about the wolves coming from, and perhaps the Wolf King. And then they found another platform that faced west, toward the Wall of Night, which stood just on the other side of the Afon Kil, the river that bounds the western edge of Tuhal and begins the unknown lands from which Matthew's characters, Sisyphus and Cecile, come in their real version or their alternate version or perhaps the dream version of them. And eventually they reached the top of the tree where there was a vast flower of the yew tree, which is also called the Tree of Memory. They found the queen, a young girl, sleeping on the flower. And at the urging of one of the queen's talking animal advisors, King Abutilon leant down and woke her with a kiss under the watchful eye of her, perhaps predictably, winged horse, which was on a platform nearby. She woke, crying out in happiness at seeing King Abutilon and his companions. And so we begin episode 8, The Sun. I'm Paul Stafford, your host in Fantasy Island. I'm Mr. Rourke, and I'm joined by my excellent fellows, who have, many of whom I've gamed with for more years than it would be decent for us to admit, and whom I feel deeply grateful to be able to game with, and I invite them to introduce themselves and perhaps for this session introduce the characters that they are becoming familiar with that are perhaps a strange analog of the characters that they began Marriage of Serpents with.
I'll start. My name is Matthew Melville. And this alternate version of Cecile and Sisyphus that I'm playing is known simply as Hope. He is a monk from the mountains of the One Land, which is a very distant area, mostly shrouded in legend. He has the power to go into what's known to his people as the Leviathan, which is a large beast-like form that he takes, and he protects the Stone of Hope, which brings comfort and confidence to those who use it. But when used too long, can bring overbearing pride and madness. And
speaking of overbearing pride and madness.
I guess I'll go. I'm John Schiavone. Yes, that's not a coincidence. I'm playing in the real world, or perhaps fake world. Kian Gallagher is normally who I'd be playing, who's a Dree wizard bonded in service of House Fane and T'Hall. But in this reality, this strange, surreal space that we're in, I'm playing Kiara, who is an ancestor in the Gallagher family. And she's famous for her dark hair, because the Gallagher family is known for their redheads, and for her eyes, which have a certain sadness, the sadness of knowing a demise that's coming and being helpless to stop it. And so she is here on a errand to bring a gift to the queen.
My name's Dale Frankie, and I have been playing a being known as
Claiborne.
Claiborne. And I am also now playing King Abutilon. In both of my forms, body holds the bones of a king. In both of my forms, I am a body shaper, changer, artist. He moves through the world slowly and carefully, and the things that he says and does are done with deliberation.
Can you hear that music?
I can.
Yeah. Very dimly, although I'm sure you know this, but in Zoom you can share a screen and also share the audio.
I know, but I don't want to. Yeah, well, maybe that'd be a... Turn that up. I don't want to share... Yeah, I don't want to share the... I don't want to do screen sharing, but I would love to just share the system audio.
I don't know how to do that.
Hang on, maybe I can. It's almost like this might be my job or something. Don't tell anyone at work. Maybe the reason that our last training session was user run is not because I was trying to engender self-authority and learning, but because I don't know what I'm doing. Who can say? No.
You know, it seems like actually a lot of things, this might be a good time to bring up. Like, I wonder if it would make sense to create a dummy account and have it join. So that way you can share screen share and it won't dominate the video, but we can all see that video. And then also if you ever want to play music, you could share the music through that dummy account. Just have, instead of the microphone, have it play the audio.
He's really smart.
Yeah, the problem is if anyone screen shares, it takes over. It doesn't matter who's doing it. It's not like it replaces their picture.
Right, but instead of screen sharing, you just set their video to the image that you want. So that way it just looks like another speaker, but instead of a speaker, it's actually the image. And so then as we're role playing.
No, but the only way to do that would be to pull up the image and screen share it. Otherwise I'd have to like have two accounts and one, or I'd have to have an account I'd have to have like my iPhone pointed at my iPad with the picture on the iPad because the camera is still running.
No, because I think what you could do is just choose, you know, it has a virtual background, so just have nothing in front of it and just set the image as the virtual background. Right?
Oh, yeah.
As long as there's face in front of it.
The way the virtual backgrounds work, I would have to use a computer to do that. And so I'd have to have another laptop. Maybe I can... Yes, I like the idea. It's a good idea. I don't think it's easy.
No, you're right.
So let's see. Let's try this. I'll screen share Apple Music and lower the volume, and we'll see how that is. If I want to be able to talk over it.
Paul, would it be too distracting if I experimented by having another, like my phone join the meeting? It's just going to be a fifth person.
That's fine. So how is that? Oh, is it sharing the audio?
It's not.
Are you hearing the audio?
No. Sadly.
Is it something you can add in post?
What if I just... I mean, I could... Whoa! Is it very loud?
Yes.
Pretty loud.
Even if I lower better. It. Okay.
But Dale's not feeling as tired anymore.
That's good. They're at the heights of the vast yew tree. A young girl maybe 10 or 12 summers upon her, with dark hair, rises from the pale veined white and lavender mouth of the yew flower. Above you spans an uncommon sight into Hall and indeed all of Mauer, the vast vault of the blue sky, unmarred by clouds. You can see from here simultaneously the three great challenges that each of the platforms you passed face. The vast storm, trying to re-devour the dawning sun, which has been dawning for the many hours you have been here. The great black bulk of the Tainwood, a vast forest that bounders the north edge of Tuhal, and the Wall of Night, which is just an empty black space on the distant western side of the River Dunkill. As the young queen wakes and sees you, she exclaims with delight. And behind you, you hear the impatient, but not aggressive, stamp and snort of the white winged horse. Your attention for a moment distracted, King Abutalon. You look back, unprepared for the physical assault that follows. The young girl is hanging from your thick neck and your broad shoulders now, and her face is buried in the folds of your upper cloak, and she's saying something, many somethings. She's saying, thank you, thank you. Oh, it's you. Oh, I waited, and it's you. You came. Oh, I don't know what I would have done without you. I don't know what would have become of everything. I think the world that I only just managed to save with my three trials and my three sacrifices, the world that I saved, even that I am now opposed in by three great and terrible kings. You have come now, you three, and you can feel the thick, warm weight of her tears through the muslin of the edge of the shoulders of your cloak. And you realize that as she has been clinging to your thick and dowdy body, and as she has been pouring out what are perhaps her child's exclamations, she has changed. And so as she pushes back away from you and looks you straight in the face, you see she is not a girl of 11 or 10, although certainly she was moments ago. She is a woman of 25 or 30 summers, with milk cream skin and raven hair that runs in complicated braids down her back. And she's clad in simple white and lavender cotton garments that hang from her shoulders, leaving her arms and shoulders bare. And you see that there are gold triskelion knots at the joins of the clothing, and she's wearing a slender chain belt of gold that isn't just a chain, but an interwoven knotwork of two serpents. And the clasp is their two sets of fangs interlocking. And she looks straight at you with pale, pale blue eyes, paler even than the morning sky. Such eyes that you feel like if you stared into them too long, you might become lost in a place too spacious to survive. And she takes a deep breath. Only the braids of her hair, her crown, and the great blue sky above. And she stands on the tips of the vast yew tree. She regards you. And then she lets go of your shoulders. And she turns and regards the other two who have come. And she nods welcome. And she nods a recognition of equals, of queen to king, and queen to high sorceress, and queen to a humble monk from another land who carries the heritage of his whole order as a likeness behind him. And then she steps back, her hands at her side, and you can see she's wearing utilitarian sandals laced up her legs, and she adjusts one of her feet as the laces have come loose, and you can see the skin duve, the black blade that many nobles in the kingdoms of Maurer carry on their persons. And she seems to collect herself. She is tall and pale and has a phone ringing inside her. She's tall and pale and she seems collected and perhaps well rested. Although the edges of her look tired nonetheless. And she takes a breath. She has a triangle of a torso, relatively broad, strong shoulders that go down to a slender woman's figure and a narrow waist, belted as it is by a gold pair of gold serpents. I see that you are the heroes. You are the Auror I dreamed of, even before I laid down to rest after my labors. I thank you and bid you welcome. And she looks around the narrow platforms at the top of the world, for surely you are nearly as high as the peaks of the Bispinwithen, of the Dragon Spine Mountains that lie beyond the Tainwood. You have much, I imagine, to speak of, but perhaps we should descend from this place.
Lead on. She
raises surprisingly caterpillar-like bushy black eyebrows in question.
Lead on, queen.
She moves past you, and there is an impatient snorful flump from the winged horse. And she looks askance at him as though they are involved in some private contest to which you are not privy. And she smiles slightly and inclines her head, but moves to the stair that rotates its way around and then into the arms of the vast tree. She leads you down. You follow?
Of course.
She leads you down and she pauses momentarily, looking out at the greenish bower among the vast waxy leaves of this yew tree that is the library, and her obvious love and comfort at the idea of being surrounded by books. And she pauses. And although you can't see her pale eyes, you know they come to rest on the vast wall of darkness that is both close and distant beyond the platform. And she makes a decision and passes on. She doesn't slow at the armory, and you're not sure if the eagle is still there or if the eagle is somewhere else, perhaps far away, watching you with an eagle's eyes. And she makes her way all the way down the many circles down through the tree itself until she presses on a section of the outer bark that did not, in your hasty advance up the hasty and perhaps breathy advance up the steps, that you didn't recognize as something that could open. And she presses on a particular knot, like a doorknob, and it seam parts and opens, and she leads you out onto a space that you haven't seen before. It's nestled on a one of the massive lower boughs, and not perhaps by cutting or some other force, but by some cunning, the bough has been encouraged to give up its roundness and spread wider than a bough normally would. And so there's a large flat space here, and there are many small benches and other comfortable places to sit that are the remains of knots in the growth of the tree, and they've been polished clean by some process. And in the midst of this space, perhaps anticipating her arrival, or perhaps they're always here, there are a small circle of great waxy leaves from the yew tree with various perishable delights in them. The smallest one in the center contains yew berries, with shining slightly luminously in the dim light that filters into this space, with that peculiar high magenta hue that yew berries have. The other leaves contain favorites of the kingdom with which you're familiar, and things that seem alien. So there are some brown breads broken into triangles, and there are some cheeses cut into similar triangles, and there seem to be a pile of cheeses with many different contents. And then there are some apples laid out, and then there are a bevy of strange seeming fruits with odd skins, some of which have been cut open and have white but peppered flesh, like an alien beast. And there are an array of perhaps difficult and luscious scents in the space. And as she enters it, she sighs, and she turns recklessly back and embraces King Ibudalon once again. And there are a couple of small gold bangles wrought with a tiny detail that ring on her hand as she embraces you. And she says, thank you again for coming. And then she looks at the other two of you. Returned. And then she looks at the other two of you and gestures toward the various seats and benches and knobs and you think that even if you wish to sit in a strange style of someone from across the Tower Sea, you might find a comfortable place to rest.
Yep. I think the monk finds a chair with a large cushion on it that permits him to what's the basic, like the lotus, anyway, allows him to sit, has no back.
Like a full lotus posture where you cross your mm-hmm. ankles over your, over yeah. your own legs.
So it's wide enough to permit that and there's no back to it.
Hmm.
Promote good posture. So, is Hope the only one who sits down, or?
She goes over, and there's obviously like a wide bench, a wide low bench that she often sits on, and but there's room. She sits slightly off center of the bench so that if someone else wanted to sit beside her, there would be room. And her eyes turn to the many treats laid out in the center. And she rubs her fingers and she looks up at Hope. And she says, those who are my advisors must have welcomed and given you the rites of welcome. And I have no salt here with which to do it. So I hope you are not discomforted by a feast that does not begin in the traditional way. Or discomforted by my hunger because I feel as though I have slept for a decade. And she kind of, her fingers sort of wiggle in the air, her short, slender fingers wiggle in the air as though she were feeling the delights on stock, and then she reaches out and picks a handful of the yew berries and pops them into her mouth. And you see that she chews them carefully and relatively undecorously just turns and spits the seeds out away from her toward the edge of the platform.
How long has your grace actually been asleep, exactly?
I would have to check. I'm not certain. Some time, I'm sure.
Kiara, as she's listening to the queen, shifts, opening up her purple robe, and pulls out a golden box, which she sets neatly on the table. And there's a thunk as she unseals it.
Mm-hmm.
And she reaches inside and pulls out a deck of cards. And she begins setting up a game of solitaire.
Are those from another land? Or are they perhaps some wizardly instrument of Cahal? He says with obvious delight. I can almost taste that they have magic. And her lips have gone a slightly pinker color from the flesh of the yew berries.
Kiara simply kind of acknowledges without answering her question, and her lips are pursed together in a very thin smile. How are we seated? In what order are we seated?
So there's a kind of longer than wider flat place with various bumps and wumps and bubbles, and in the kind of flat bowl amid the various weird seats and things, there's the food. And so you could sit in a rough circle, or you could sit off to the side, or stand by the opening, or however you like.
I think as we're all, hold on one moment, as we're all getting seated, Kiara is about to sit down next to the queen, and from her position, about to take that seat, she seems to notice something, and she, with a thin air of calculation, instead reaches for a bit of fruit and takes a seat on the other side, putting her two chairs away from the queen. I don't know where Hope and King Abudalon is, but she leaves one of them between her and the queen.
You've picked up one of the foreign fruits, which is strange to your eye. And it has a sort of knobbly, cactus-like magenta skin with a sort of radiant vermilion inner husk. And then the fruit of it is stark, pure, absolute white with little black circles run through it. And as you sit down, you slightly regret your choice because it smells a little bit like feet.
She actually doesn't even seem to acknowledge the fruit.
Okay.
After she picked it up.
Yeah.
And just puts it on her plate. But then as she continues and has that exchange where she starts playing the deck with the deck of cards, she draws a certain card, and it's the Hanged Man. On the card is the image of the Hanged Man, and she stops, and she kind of stops as if interrupted, and in the corner of her mouth, I think just in hearing, but deliberately out of hearing of the queen, she murmurs, "I can hear you struggling in there. Don't worry, I notice it too." And then she continues playing.
So Hope and King Abudalon, what are you doing? As the ladies seem to have gone slightly mad.
So there's no meat, right?
There is no meat.
Okay. Monk reaches out and gets some cheese and puts on a little bit of bread and happily is kind of munching along.
It's a small round, maybe the size of your palm, and maybe half your index finger in height. And you realize that it has a thin layer of beeswax surrounding it. And as you break inside, at first you think, oh, this cheese must have gone wrong, because there are little white things like maggots in the pale flesh of the cheese. But then when they don't move, and a sort of pleasantly acid smell rises, you realize, oh, they're little pellets of garlic that have lived inside the cheese so long they've become a part of it. And so the whole body of the small cheese has been thoroughly infused with the essence of garlic. And the sealing of the wax has kept the whole thing soft. And so you can just like scoop it with a finger like camembert. It is a delight unlike is known in your homeland.
Monk makes appreciative noises that are perhaps aimed more at lesser company than this, but...
Oh, the queen says around another mouthful of yew berries. That's my favorite. I call it the maggot cheese.
It's very good.
Oh, she points to some slightly like half-closed kind of trumpet-like, but incredibly oversized yew flowers, maybe the length of, well, something long and horny. She points at them and says, oh, the blossoms are full of morning water. It's very sweet and slightly scented by the tree. Very refreshing. And then King Abutilon.
There's an area of this platform where the shapes become more, both wilder and closer together. And he approaches that area and slips into it and then begins to weave his body in and out through the various shapes. His abilities as a contortionist are on display and are frankly astounding. As he stretches and exercises himself, and occasionally an impossibly long, slender arm reaches out and plucks something from the table, and then withdraws back into the forest of shapes.
So I think there's a mesh of slender green boughs that have grown all around this space, almost like the web of an orb spider. And so you weave yourself in among the weaving, which in the place above the fruit is low to begin with. And so it sort of depends with your body and allows you to reach the goodies as you sort of lie in the anti-pull of the tree from gravity.
Yes. And I will occasionally hang by my feet from boughs above the table in order to swing down and grab some dainty.
The first thing you grab are unfamiliar to you from your hot desert home. Blackberries. And these are not the long, slender, cone-like blackberries grown in a farm. These are the low, squat, wide, fat blackberries that lived in the dark soil at the edge of Maurer's rivers for their entire life, where time out of mind and in total uninterest to the death of the dragon, they continued flowering and
interesting
and producing a dark sweetness next to the black water. And there is a taste in the blackberries somewhere between mud and eternity.
That's a pretty broad.
Or is it?
A lot of flavors in between those.
Lady, from your garb, and your demeanor, and no less your northern beauty, I deduce that you are one of the Cherna, one of the Dri Cherna of Cathal, and I feel that where the eye remained to me, I would see many splendorous things of your accomplishments and your powers and potencies. But in this half of my reign that is now in the light, I am blind to such things. And I can see only that you are a northerner of some skill and talent, and that this is not some game that you are offering to play with us, but something else. Do you have some oracle to bear as we begin to speak?
As Kara is eyeing the blackberries, she draws the death card. As she places it down next to the hanged man. And then a little bit louder now, in everybody's hearing, she says, "Yes, even now. Yes, again." She murmurs to herself even as the queen is talking to her. And then she clears the deck and starts again. And then finally, there's a long kind of long moment of silence after the queen finishes her question, where there might be a question of whether Kara had even heard her. And just before anybody can fill that silence, uncomfortable as it's becoming, Kara makes eye contact and says, I don't have an answer for you yet. But perhaps I will before we're finished here. Have you..."
She nods as though this is a tea time entertainment.
Kara just smiles that same very thin-lipped smile from before. "How did you lose the sight, Your Grace?"
"It was one of the three sacrifices that I made in order to save Cathal.
That sounds like quite a story."
"Well, the years of my becoming have not been uneventful, except perhaps for this slumber when I was finally allowed to rest."
"Did you accomplish what you set out to do?"
She gestures toward the morning light, failing to pierce the green shroud of the yew tree around you.
As
though toward a child's drawing, proudly displayed.
As she gestures to that light with, I assume, perhaps some pride, What card does Kara draw?
The sun.
She shuffles the deck again.
And she looks back. "As anyone, any of those in my court, or any of those who have sheltered here for the... Oh, we lost.
Oh, no.
King of Budalon fall off the pavilion.
The tree eats him. And makes a new flower. Oh, no, is that where those come from?
Or gets sucked into the darkness like the book.
Why? I'm going to pause the recording. Oops. And then and there's maybe a moment of internal dissonance of like, why did I look away? I don't care. Anyway, Kiara, John.
Kiara kind of eyes the cart for a long moment before sliding it back, and seems to be mulling over a response very carefully. And then she sets it neatly back into the box and closes the lid.
As your pale fingers draw attention to the box, tell us what it looks like.
I think it's a bronze box container, and it's very ornate with the serpent, the dragon, and some other ethereal kind of design, which could be the mist, all grappling for control over the contents of the box. So I think each of the little legs are kind of either be a leg of a serpent or leg of a dragon, as they're kind of vying over kind of the contents. And then this kind of ethereal kind of knotwork covering the top of it, which could be the mist, forming the structure of the box.
And if I may, I think as Kiara examines that, she realizes that the basis of this struggle is the triple knot, the triskelion. Mm-hmm. Mm.
In a manner that is not clearly not designed to be rude, but yet very obviously and overtly avoids the queen's question entirely. She kind of looks up and kind of touches behind her own ear. You have a strange mark, Your Grace.
He reaches up on the wrong side.
Is that,
you know, in the mirror way that people do?
And then she doesn't say that she's wrong, but she kind of does the other side. Was that part of the sacrifice that you made?
No. She pulls her free and knotted hair aside. And the three of you can see there's a faint, like, triple whorl, like red, almost like a pimple or a blister or a, like an irritation. There's like a three-spotted, like, triple whorl mark below her right ear, like at the nape of her skull. And she sort of, I hadn't noticed it until you pointed it out. Perhaps the pollen from my slumber.
It's a very particular mark. If you had the sight at one time, I would assume you to be familiar.
Is it the mark of the world? The Triskelion?
Kiara just nods.
I have no knowledge of it, except perhaps that I have made 3 sacrifices to preserve the world as it is.
You understand what the Triskelion means?
It is the 3 souls. It is the dragon and the serpent and the mist. It is the night and the day and the twilight. It's youth and age and vigor. It's many things. And in saying that, you can all hear a ring. It's as though her words are touching lightly on a silver bell in your mind that corresponds to the world.
Kara's fingers almost unknowingly drift along the line of the dragon on the box. You seem very interested in magic, Your Grace.
Yes. Magic is the magic I've found is what with the gift 3 gifts I have received is what preserves the world. And so, of course, is it? Oh, I see. You reference the ancient prejudice against magic in this kingdom. I assure you that things have changed. And perhaps Cahal, being sheltered as it is in the arms of the dragon's spine, you have not, the impact of those changes has not reached your high kingdom, which makes your presence here all the more astonishing.
Kiara simply smiles that same thin smile from before, and nods. That is a very gracious interpretation, Your Grace. I'm afraid the
prejudice... I assure you, lady, even though you haven't given me your name, and I have no salt with which to give you the grace of Mahan, who I'm certain gives it any longer, you are safe in this place. You've come as one of the Aurora of whom I dreamed, and the many members of my court greeted you and allowed you into this place, guarding me as they did in my sleep. You are safe and among friends.
It's not my safety that I am concerned about. She pushes the box away from her several inches. I pray your forgiveness. I came here. My name is Kiara. I came here to bestow upon you a gift to help fight the encroaching darkness. But now, upon seeing you in person, I fear if you have too much power already. The mark behind your ear is not simply a reflection of the struggle between the powers of this world. It's also a sign of consumption. Toying with magic is like wrestling in quicksand. It is very possible, perhaps even likely, that one is consumed by the thing that you are trying to master.
She looks around in the green light of the tree. I'm not entirely certain I understand, but all of my efforts have been of discovery and self-discovery, and surely I do not understand the laws of magic as well as one who is a master of them from a kingdom born of it. So Hope and Abutilon, what are you guys doing?
Abutilon has stopped winding himself through various objects and has settled into a lounging pose among them. His face is troubled.
Hope is finishing his meal, kind of looking curiously between the various members, but seemingly unfazed by the contention. Almost as if he had some relic on him that promoted harmony and hope in the future.
Kiara reaches, you know, she had pushed the box several inches away, and she reaches out for it again and kind of gets up from her seat, and she begins pushing it towards the queen and stops halfway. And there's a moment where her eyes kind of go glassy, and then her other hand slams the table. "This is not your time," she whispers to herself. And then continues pushing the box forward towards the queen.
Your Grace. I imagine it seems as though the queen were at the top of a great hill. That every inch of pushing requires another inch of effort on Kiara's part.
Well, and then I think as she's pushing it, when she slams her hand against the table and she says that this is not your time, There's an immediate relenting, and it's almost like she, in preparation of resistance, didn't expect there to not be resistance and pushed it like way more forcefully than she expected, so that the box kind of almost tumble, actually I think it does tumble over, and the deck of cards spills out of it, and they all kind of reveal outwards, spilling outwards towards the queen. And she kind of sits back in her seat, almost like exhausted, and says, forgiveness, please, Your Grace. But I would be very curious to hear what the deck has to tell you. And then she leans back as if spent.
She looks down at the cards, and there are of the cards fanned out on the floor, on the smooth yew wood in front of her. There are four upright, and there are three kind of in a triangle, and they are the Emperor, the Devil, and Strength. And Strength is a woman wrestling a lion. And then in the middle is the Ten of Swords, which is a woman blindfolded about to be run through with a bunch of swords. And she looks down at them and looks up at you and looks down at them and looks up at you and says, What remarkable artwork you've crafted. Sorry, Matthew, what was that?
Oh, no, never mind.
And she obviously reaches some decision and then reaches down with her hands to gather the cards, and of their own volition, they together and hop back into the box, and the box snaps shut, and she sort of stops and looks up.
Awkward.
I have been warned that the lessons of wizards are challenging. And I assure you, I am ready for the challenge. And she reaches out with one pale, short-fingered hand that hovers for a moment above the shining of the brass box, and then her fingers rest on it with no consequence, and she draws it across the table and kind of slides it to the side beside her. I thank you, Lady Kiara, for coming across the space from your home and bringing me this gift.
Our bows.
The loss of the eye has been grave in the later years of my rule, and it seems that this will be an insight that may replace and even supplant that questionable gift of the talent. She looks down, a woman of young middle years, struggling with being a queen, and she rises in a sudden impulse and rushes around the table to embrace you.
I think Kiara is stunned, but doesn't resist.
And then she sort of winds her hands in the complex pleats of her lower robe and returns to her place and pulls her small legs up underneath her to sit cross-legged on the bench under her skirt.
If it please the queen, I have also brought you a gift.
Oh.
But it's a gift that's best experienced in moderation.
As you say that, all three of you become aware of a vertical scar on the queen's chest that runs from the cleft of her clavicle to just above the empty space where the diaphragm begins under the ribs. So there's a visible but quiet scar that runs the length of her breastbone as she turns to regard you. It may be that the green light of this bower has become greener still as hope began to speak. Go on.
This comes from my land, and I have brought it to many. And I have saved it from others who would have made ill use of it. The power of the stone is immense. It can bring feelings of euphoria and joy and happiness. But if not used in moderation, if kept and coveted forever, then it brings ruin.
And as you say this, what are you doing?
So he's pulled it out from underneath his tunic, and he's just sort of holding it up. And it seems to kind of lighten the room a little bit even more with some green light.
And so then, as you spoke, your eyes were on the jewel, because any living being that has ever felt loss would fasten its eyes on the jewel when it was brought into the open air. And as you finish and look past the jewel at the queen, there are clear streaks of tears running from her eyes, and there are tears literally dripping from her chin as she looks past the jewel at you. And her eyes, which are like the palest lapis before, have gone the palest viridian in the way that blue and green, as in the sea, are the same color. And she holds up her hands like to keep you away. Mm-hmm. And she says, I judge by your appearance and demeanor that you have come from the lands beyond the Tower Sea, and I see that this is a great gift, but in this moment it seems. And she presses two fingers to the scar on her chest, and it seems livid, where a moment before it was barely noticeable. Mm-hmm. It seems in this moment too difficult for me to bear. If you would hold it for me. And her fingers tremble as she sort of holds her hand out toward you.
As you wish. But
she nods many times. What do you do with the jewel? You can feel like we're just gonna go on. You can feel there's almost like there's a warmth. What's the chain made of that the jewel hangs on?
So I think the jewel's been set with, it's been kind of attached into like a little thing of gold, but then what holds it is just, some like woven rattan cord.
Okay. So you can almost feel a thrum in the rattan. Mm-hmm. Rattan is an interesting substance for that to be made of. So you can feel almost a like a thrumming resonance in the rattan, like the emerald is beating like a heart. And you've never felt that before.
Find a way to please talk amongst yourselves.
We've been doing some of that.
So the queen's hand trembles as she both.
Are you recording?
Out to yes.
Okay.
She both reaches out to defend herself from and maybe prevent herself from reaching for Jewel. And you hope experience a feeling you've never felt before, which is the Hope Emerald beating as if like a heart.
Queen, have you experienced this gem before?
No, we've not met. And I have no memory of this thing. And she again presses at the scar that runs the length of her breastbone in a sort of bittersweet pain.
Never met one who the stone has brought suffering to. This is a first.
I thought you just described ruin, Kara says curiously.
Well, yes. But that was, if you'll permit me, too much of a good thing. A lack of moderation. Moving out of balance. In fact, where the stone was too powerful, I've never seen it be harmful at first.
Have you ever given the stone to someone who ached more for having lost it afterwards than had you given it to them in the first place?
Yes. The queen's head snaps towards you like a pennant on a swivel.
I have, on occasion. Generally, the success is measured whether the stone goes to those who are struggling with a difficult transition or a difficult time. The stone's ability lies in that it helps people complete that. That it gives them the ability to accomplish that which they were unable to do without it. At which point, the hope is that the accomplishment of that, the success, will continue to drive hope in their lives, and they will no longer need the stone as much. But
hey,
Kara meets the queen's gaze inscrutably.
She's looking, flicking her gaze back and forth between the stone and the monk. And then she looks down at the feast still remaining in the circle between you. She lowers her hand from the scar on her over her breastbone. I gave my heart to a hero for this. Came early to the kingdom. And that's that strength has allowed him to fight back many of the kingdom's enemies and even fight back the great storm.
She said she gave her heart to who? To what?
A hero.
Is he... Does he still fight?
Yes.
If he were to prevail, will he return your heart?
I cannot say. I think it would be the end of him to do so. The end of them.
Them.
She nods. My Fianna Fáil, and you all know, or at least Kiara, you know, she means her bound and faithful warriors, as any Tiarna would have. My protectors, she says, for the benefit of the two foreigners. The feel of its light on my skin is like it's a longing I can't describe. She wipes somewhat shamelessly a tear from one eye. I am grateful for the gift, but I think that you should continue to hold it for me for now, if you don't mind. Your name is Hope as well. Is that right?
It is.
I am grateful to you, Hope, for having come across the miles of the world and the sea.
Tell me, Queen, is it that you fear dredging up old wounds with the stone? Or is it more that you fear a loss of control?
She looks away into the simpler green light of the yew tree. There's some ick. The stone awakens in me that I can hardly stand. I don't know how she sleeps.
I understand.
Perhaps I'm not yet ready for both. And she looks down at her yew-berry-stained fingers and wipes them stainingly on the pale expanses of the turns of her dress. Mm. I know somehow your lips pressed against my cheek that you were called Butylon. And it's like I can taste the sands, the sunlit sands of the south, your kiss, but I don't know. I know nothing else about you except that I hold gratitude for your coming.
I too have brought you a gift, my queen.
She nods her head.
I know what it is, but I don't know what it is.
A riddle, then.
Perhaps you will know what it is. He makes his way over to the area of this platform where we first arrived. And as he does this, he tells a story of this thing. In my lands, there is a place where time is strange. Slow and fast and broken and strange. And sometimes things there happen and they stop and keep happening forever. And he pulls a wrapped, a bundle from a bag that he left near the opening to the platform and brings it to the table and begins to slowly unwrap it, unbinding these. It's wrapped in green leaves that have retained their moisture and greenness somehow. Large, flat, thick leaves like a rubber plant, but eight times the size.
Bound. She smiles at green leaves.
Bound in green vines. And what he uncovers is apparently an earthen tube, perhaps as long as a forearm and a hand's breadth across. Grit and sand falls from it as he lifts it from its wrappings, and the center of the tube, the hollow space within, is exploding with blue-white light. Mm. this comes from that place where time is broken. Lightning struck the ground and passed into it and then stopped. And this is a piece of that ground and a piece of that lightning. Three people were killed by the excavation of it. I don't know what it is or what you will do with it. I was advised to bring it to you.
It seems strange that of the three gifts I have been offered on waking, the one of which I have no fear is lightning. And she laughs, and her laugh is clear and sweet and free. And there's something in you that would do a lot to make sure that she laughed again. And she rubs her fingers together. They wiggle like they did when she was considering the delights in the center of the table. And she reaches slowly out toward the gray surface of the fulgurite. And the blue-white lightning dances inside. And as she reaches out toward it, little fingers of St. Elmo's fire flicker and then are gone between her hand and the fulgurite. Yeah. And she laughs, a woman's uncomplicated laughter. A delight. And then seizing courage, she picks the fulgurite up and holds it up, and nothing happens. And she looks at it and laughs again. I expect the use of this will come evidence in the fullness of time. It is curious that there are three of you who have brought me three such excellent gifts. She gently and with respect lays the fulgurite down beside the brass cube holding the plaques of divination and the St. Elmo's plasma fire fingers of the fulgurite choose not to play on the brass surface containing the plaques, as you might expect they would. And they leave little lingering, hopeful fingers of light in your eyes as she lets go of it. The kingdom is beset by three great challenges. And I have made three great sacrifices to sustain the world. And I have undertaken three great labors to sustain the kingdom. Somehow the three of you are what I hoped for without knowing I was hoping. I pray that you have not come simply to lay these three gifts on the tree, but that the three of you have come to exercise your gifts as the mighty heroes that you clearly are in service of the Sunrise Kingdom. Is that true? And if there is some inner division within you between who you remember and who you are in this moment, there is electricity, there is a frisson in the gap between those two as she asks the question. As you have no immediate answer, let me tell you of the three enemies that beset the Sunrise Kingdom. Let me tell you of what came with us out of the second darkness. As I said before, the enemies of the Sunrise Kingdom are three. There is in the Tainwood, in the north, in the mountains, the Yellow King, also called by some the Yellow Stranger. If you go outside at dusk or at dawn, at the changing of the day, and you listen, you can hear his song as he calls in all the strange and difficult things of the world. And it is he who sends or authorizes the Yellow Strangers to move among my kingdom and adopt those who are lost and feckless into their number. I cannot imagine what they want or what they...
We did talk with one on our way here, or rather, she talked with us.
If these are servants of one of the enemies of this kingdom, why are they permitted to walk freely?
It seems to me they have fallen under a strange and incomprehensible spell. And I have no heart to imprison them for their error. There is also the black sorcerer called the Wolf King that sends his servants, his men, in among us as wolves in men's clothing, and sometimes only as wolves. They're mad and violent and brilliant and terrible. And then,
is that where the decorations come from? All the wolf teeth and claws and things that we see all over your kingdom are those trophies.
Yes, and they They seem to discomfort the yellow strangers and contain their activities, and so I cannot stop my people from this strange practice that seems to comfort them and give the yellow strangers pause. And then among my own people, there is the Bandit King. He's impossible to reason with, impossible to stop, impossibly clever. A seducer of women and a convincer of men. He raises difficulty and chaos in here in Kerkuval and beyond.
What is his hold over the people? Does he have power or simply influence?
As I said, one of my sacrifices was the sight, and so I cannot see deeply into his influence or intent, but he seems capricious, mad. Out only for his delight in causing trouble. Were you relayed by the Bandit King? She asks Hope.
I do not recall being waylaid, though we did meet some interesting figures on our way in. Creatures of darkness and of shadow, robed.
The visage of the dead god of death himself.
Oh. The white strangers. They are, I can also not explain. The gods fell decades ago, in the gods fall wars, and why this one image of the god of death haunts my kingdom, I cannot say, and it is never manifested in my presence, although I find trace of it where most times where some change has come to the kingdom fresh. And so in the early days of pushing back the darkness, sightings of the white stranger were common. But now they are rare, at least here.
My grace, your grace, would you tell me what you sacrificed and what labors you undertook? Perhaps it would inspire us.
She nods and looks down and knots her hands together. My ring has not been easy in the even these many years later, the dark times have not been forgotten. But yes, I made three sacrifices to undo the darkness that fell across the world. There was a champion in the dark, a nameless and towering hero who fell in defense of my life and others. And as he lay dying, I gave him my heart to give him new life. And it gave him strength again. And it gave him more bodies than one, all the same. And he pledged his many selves to be my Fianna Fáil, to be my great heroes and defend the kingdom. In the darkness and chaos, as light had fled from the world, I sacrificed the flower of my womanhood for the birth of the tree, that it might become a stable stalk at the heart of our kingdom and sustain it, which it has. And then, though the goddess is gone, for news traveled everywhere of the death of Pronabin first to fall, I felt at a point in the dark Pronabin's kiss. And I gave the gift of my sight that the sun might rise again. And it has hung ever since in the air. She gestures to the likeness in the east.
These gifts.
And also inside Dale's fridge.
These gifts you describe go far beyond the exchange of magic. How did you broker such an exchange for this kingdom?
It was an instinct. Even when I was very young, I knew there was something different about me. But when the darkness came, it seemed to seemed like a fire about to happen. And I just knew that I could parcel out pieces of it to save the world, and I did. I know this is not the kind of learned magic. That you bear, Lady Kiara. And I'm certain that in many ways I must seem ignorant to you. But I've only done what I can. if that makes sense.
You've done far more than anyone else could.
You say that not with delight.
Oh, she doesn't usually say things with delight. She's cautious.
She smiles thinly at that and says, I say it with fear and gratitude, both.
If I could account for the strangeness of days and my part in it, I would. But I can only do so as a reverie.
We are all servants. Kara says with a certain harmony.
There is a humbling wisdom in what you say. And I feel in some way that the serpent has taken my sight to teach me humility. That I must struggle with things that once were as obvious as green grass. And I do not understand why the day does not proceed and why the dawn does not finish. I don't understand the wall of night, because it seems to me both as though it's always been there, and though as though it is impossible and unnatural. I feel that I should understand the chanting of the Yellow King, that it is perhaps the most important thing. But it's simple, almost a child's lullaby. And though I labor with my books, no wisdom comes. The Wolf King, the Black Sorcerer, has taken many of the great heroes of my kingdom, and even come at times to the wall of yew trees around the crown and threatened our very existence. And so, as pleasant as this is, I feel more awake than I have been in many years. And perhaps that is a result of resting, but I think perhaps it is more a result of your presence here, and I think that we should not waste our time, that we should go to the east, to the Godswood, where my Fianna Fáil labor against the storm and support them, or we should go north. And I think, if I am not mistaken, that the ravens, even now that my armies have fallen, that they have taken up the fight against the servants of the Wolf King, that we could join and reinforce them and learn something from their battle with the wolves, or perhaps while that battle is in progress, we could slip by them into the dark woods and we could find the Yellow King and wrestle from him the truth of his chant, or steal from him the power of it and finish the day and drive back the night.
It's that last one that interests me the most. Seems the world is out of balance. With all due respect, Queen, I did not come this way to fight your wars, but that seems like a great imbalance in the world, and I would be honored to undertake that journey with you.
And I would not expect you to fight my battles for me. And I'm grateful for any guest that you would undertake in this kingdom.
My queen, the way you have described these enemies and their behavior, all three of them speak to me clearly of fear. There are those who, when confronted with fearful things in their life, turn to their conception of the divine and lose themselves in it and chant mindless chants for the comfort of belief. There are those who, struck by fear, strike back at others with violence and bloodthirstiness. And there are those who give in to the fear and sow chaos, thinking that perhaps by joining with a greater fear, they will escape its talons. And so perhaps it is the fear that must be fought, not these small wars.
What does victory against fear look like? Kara asks.
Historically, victory against fear looks like forgetfulness. It looks like taking actions that during times of fear would look like carelessness.
Kara does not seem so satisfied with that, but she doesn't.
It's a wholesome feeling of nonchalantness.
I feel that you are having some fun, which we are not privy to. Hope.
Oh, well, suppose I'm a little bit of a philosopher on hope and emotion. It comes a little bit with the job. I get a lot of questions in that vein. I've been accused of being an unfeeling optimist. And I'm blessed to work with my companion, who is a realist through and through. And Garrow together we balance each other. Thinly. A realist who talks to her cards.
What companion is this? She points at Kiara, questioning him.
Kiara nods.
So, if we are not to confront the Dark Kings, how do we fight fear? If you say that my kingdom is beset on three sides by the three faces of fear, and you three seem to be the three faces of hope, how is it that we do not, that we win by not confronting them?
We should go and check out these threats each in turn. But often
Kiara looks at King Abudalon thoughtfully. Did I cut you off, Matthew, or were you?
No, go for it.
She looks at King Abudalon thoughtfully and says, perhaps, as she tilts her head deferentially, if I'm not mistaken, perhaps what my companion is saying is that victory might not look like what we expected to. That the confrontation, the struggle, and the victory might not look like what we're expecting it to.
A white tooth, she smiles broadly. Never have the advisors of my kingdom spoken in this way. You are surely the heroes that we require. All right, where do we begin?
You said the Yellow King? Was it?
Yes. Not? Yes. In the fastness of the Tainwood. That's where the chanting comes from. And to where I think the Yellow Stranger's report.
What if we were to talk to the Yellow Strangers here in your city?
They might have a way for us to get where we're going.
They're like the bees. They hum and buzz, but in the end, say nothing.
Mm-hmm. The woman who approached us in the market seemed like she had something to say.
That is the seeming, but if it is the case, the message is not the message. Because their talk is it is simple and folds back upon itself. And it is a comfort to the simple, whom a small world benefits. but to others they seem only mad.
Do you think that there is a danger in hearing it?
I think for three such as you, the danger is only boredom.
I am willing to risk such. Mm-hmm. I have risked it before. I have met many philosophers who are sometimes prone to such. She says, eyeing Hope very obliquely.
He thinks to himself, really, I must have been absent during those occasions. I've always found philosophers to be regal beings with endless amounts of fascinating tidbits to share with their audience.
Exactly.
Why, if the world would only listen more to its philosophers, I think it would be a much better, brighter place.
Exactly. Would you agree? She says.
He seems speechless. That must have been some kiss.
And then, scene swipe. You're among the babble of the market, and the queen is dressed both more meanly and more for battle than she was before. She wears a finely made, a simply spun dark blue cloak, but underneath it, she has changed the dress for a simple tunic and a leather battle skirt with bracers on her arms and at her ankles, and ski and duve at ankle and at wrist, and a short sword on the battle skirt across her back. And she follows you at a small distance and quietly into the enclave of the yellow strangers. It's a small, warm, and dimly lit place with yellow tarps overhead that only admit a certain kind of light, and many candles besides. And heard the queen's talk earlier of bees doesn't leave your head. And somehow as you go into the warm cloister of the yellow strangers, this cloister of the yellow strangers in the city, it doesn't seem an inapt metaphor. It's a close yellow lit place, smelling of wax and warm and touched by warm yellow light. And there are many, and there is the soft buzzing of conversation with rhythm, but not much content. And you're shown in and given bowls of a delicious smelling golden broth at some of the long tables in the tent. And there are many small tents adjoining this one. And some of them seem to lead back off into sales booths in the new market, as though these yellow strangers have goods that they are plying as well. And eventually a familiar looking blonde woman in a long single braid, and it looks like her hair is perhaps not entirely a natural blonde, but through the application of some of the cunning alchemy of Tuhal, has become yellower than once it was. And she sits down across from you in her simple homespun cloak that, though butter yellow, seems much like the queen's, as the queen regards the table at your side and does not partake of the broth in the bowl.
Mm.
And she says, "Oh, and it's good to see you again, my friends. You've come back from that strange and spacious mound in the center of our kingdom. Have you learned anything?"
"A couple things."
She sort of urges you on with a, like, "Yes."
"It would be difficult for me to know what would be of interest to you. I come with a foreigner's eyes, so many things that for you might be normal, for me might be strange customs. For example, I had a lively conversation with one of the ravens in the building."
"It's said that the ravens are the souls of warriors who died in the queen's service and were bound and cannot escape, and therefore returned in the bodies of birds." "Hmm." There's a from the queen nearby.
"I see. And the eagle? There was also an eagle that spoke. Is there a legend behind them as well?"
"And it said that all those that opposed the queen's reign were bound by her into her service in the shapes of animals." Says the queen nearby.
"We also learned that a little bit of whom you serve said that there's a yellow king."
She looks honestly a little confused. "We were the friends of everyone. Serve no king."
"So you don't know who we speak of?" "Hmm.
And how do you serve everyone?"
There is a disorder upon the land represented by the Queen of Mourning, who keeps the world forever in a state of mourning and keeps the natural cycles from happening. We seek to establish a brotherhood of the order of things and return the world to the way it is."
"Do you not think that's what I'm fucking trying to do?" says the queen.
No longer able to contain herself.
"Oh, your majesty, I didn't know that I, excuse me."
"Don't get up," Kiara says with a voice that almost fills the entire building.
Sorry, what did you say?
I said, "Don't get up." Just as okay, she says,
excuse me. She plants her hands on the table as if to push herself to her feet, and then like, as though her butt is glued to the chair, to the plank.
There we go.
Says Queen Aya. Sorry.
Hope kind of reaches out and kind of just gently kind of like strokes her hand in a gesture that he's hoping is conciliatory. Now, dear, let's not be so quick to get up and run off.
Kara reaches over in front of Queen Aya and says, I wonder if you brought my gift. I think this would be a wonderful time for a game. Don't you? She says, looking over at the yellow stranger.
She looked right and left as though trying to see who you're talking to without turning her head. I did, says the queen, drawing out the brass box and setting it shining on the table.
Kara kind of inclines her head and reaches for the box, but doesn't touch it until Queen Aya kind of nods assent.
Oh, she gestures like, oh, please.
She flips it open. Interestingly,
hang on. The woman with the dyed blonde hair looks pleadingly at you, Hope, like, get me out of this.
Interestingly,
Hope just sort of nods and says, don't worry, this will be over soon. One way or another.
Okay.
Interestingly, when Kara first opened the box, there was the sound of it unsealing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the queen opened it later, there was that same sound. But now when she opens up, it's not sealed. It just pops right open. Mm-hmm. And she reaches in and grabs the deck of cards and deals a hand out to everybody at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And as she begins dealing the cards out, she explains the rules, which the player is not entirely certain of, but I'm sure that there are.
She snaps at Hope as he's like peeking a little bit. Hope!
I don't think she snaps at Hope. She just deals the cards to everybody else, like sliding them across the table, and then like gives Hope's cards like face down with her hand on top of them.
He sort of just steeples his fingers and tries to look as if he would never, ever consider turning them over.
Okay, so each of the three of you have a question about the yellow strangers or the yellow king.
I yield my question to Queen Aya. It's her deck.
She looks the blonde woman until the woman looks up, and then you see her kind of like struggling to look away from the queen, and you, Ibutalon, especially sympathize with the blonde woman as she must be falling through the vast lapis spaces of the queen's gaze. And she says, what does the Yellow King want of my kingdom? And the woman looks down and then looks up, and in a man's ancient, quiet, deep voice, she says, everything. And more. Then the queen looks a little startled.
So are these all things we're asking him, or things that we're asking the cards? What is the nature?
So the queen holding the cards folded them and put them down and asked her a question. Do as you will.
So more towards the cards. What is the nature of the Yellow King's madness? Are you sending me a message? Where's
John? That was me typing.
Okay. You lay your hand down and there's a card with spilled cups with wine flowing off a sacrificial table, and there's a card with a swirl of the stars of the heavens above, and and there's a card with a bunch of maybe tree limbs or staves carved from trees, kind of laid together in a grid, almost like a fence to keep things out. And you feel like the answer is, so say the question one more time.
What is the nature of this king's madness? Or condition?
And the answer that occurs to you is, it is the madness of an unexpected failure and filled with terror, trying to keep out what comes next. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Matt totally stole my question.
Rude.
I was going to ask, what is the Yellow King afraid of? Is the Yellow King responsible for the Great Darkness?
One moment, please. Your cards are the Hermit, a man standing alone with a single light rays that doesn't illuminate anything, and the Fool, who's a happy man about to step off the cliff. Mm-hmm. And so the answer seems to be yes, but not purposefully. You've gone and brought the Queen Aya here. The woman, the straw-haired woman, says to the three of you. And she blinks and kind of looks around. I have a son and a husband that's a blacksmith that I love. And I can't remember why I left them behind. I need to go. And she lays her hands on the table and gingerly tries to get up, which she succeeds at. And she nods. I don't know who you are, but thank you, and I hope we don't meet again.
Before you go.
And she stands up and begins wrestling with the clasp of the yellow cloak around her neck.
Before you go.
The queen is smiling and looking at Kiara.
Can you tell us if you remember? What happened? Not the why, but the what. Or is the memory gone?
What happens when? She says, stopping in the moment before releasing the clasp on the cloak.
Kara nods at her to continue. When you decided to put that on.
Falls down. She shakes her head, like to speak several times and shakes her head.
Be safe.
She nods, and there are other straw-haired women moving toward you now. And she looks at them and does a 1-2 step bench tabletop and leaps between Kiara, between you and the queen, and sprints out through the open tent flaps. And Kiara stands up and reaches back and draws a shillelagh out from where it was suspended along her lower back, and looks at the group of you. So we set things right.
Wait, who said that?
The queen.
Oh yeah.
as the straw-haired women are moving quickly toward you.
Kara actually remains seated.
Are the women who are approaching us armed?
Not obviously.
Okay.
But they are moving towards you in a threatening manner.
Right.
She looks up at the queen and she says, every single one of these women, is it just women or women and men?
It does seem to only be women.
Every single one of these women has a story like hers. And then Kiara gets up and looks at the gathering yellow strangers. You won't win this fight. I suggest you let us leave.
They pause, grateful for the advice, and arm themselves.
What's around the room? Is there anything...
Vases, pots, pans, tables, chairs, seats, tents, tent poles.
Okay. So just pretty basic stuff. Nothing that really stands out.
Yeah.
Okay. Is anyone like kind of close to Hope as they come?
Sure.
Can he stand up suddenly and like yank off their yellow shawl? Or they're yellow.
Sure. Sure, this one could be a shawl.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And as he does so, he wants to look into her eyes to see if that's part of the magic or if that's just a vague accompaniment to it.
So I think he rips off her shawl and it sort of spins her dizzyingly around. And then she locks eyes with him and then and there's sort of like a and as she does, there's a yellow burn in her eyes and there's an emerald burn in his, and the two seem to be in contest, and then a melee ensues in which none of these heroes are truly endangered or deeply under threat. But somehow in their service to the kingdom, as they work with the blows and threats of the yellow strangers and convert them in some way to the movements of the kingdoms, of the kingdom, each of the heroes in their own way realizes that this is useful, that they are needed. And that if the span of their endless numbered days were spent here in the Morning Kingdom, they would be valuable and honored and good. And we'll stop there. geeking out at the credits, any reflections on the role playing of your fellows?
So the card mechanic was a lot of fun, John. I rather enjoyed that.
Thank you. I really loved how you played Hope's just kind of very his kind of mischievous nature. I really enjoyed that from session to session, and I enjoyed King Abudalon's question regarding the kings that we're confronting, whether they're a reflection of fear. I have a question. Should we fill out character sheets for these characters?
Sure. I'll send you the details I've collected.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I'm a little disappointed that I didn't get to show off Abudalon's war form. That's my contribution to the geeking out. I'm putting the geek in geeking out. both of you, all three of you, I'm so glad I decided not to shut down the session.
Good.
Yay.
And watching you all fall into these new and relatively unknown characters. I'd be perfectly happy continuing in these forms or going back to our previous circumstances.
Yeah.
I'd rather enjoy the frisson between our characters. Kian's in there. and has opinions.
Yeah, cool. That was very nice. Thank you for playing that that worm squiggling under the surface of the flesh.
And the queen.
I'd like Matthew, to suggest an alternate subtitle for this episode, which is "Talk to Strangers."
I like it.
No, I was just saying I really liked that with the queen, that she would kind of be the first person who Hope is too much for her. as in the stone, not the individual. I'm sure that's happened before, but but the idea that she's at a point where she can't really afford hope, and him being a little taken aback by it. Well, that hasn't happened before.
Right. I have the prize of inestimable worth. Oh, no, I can't have that.
Right.
Right. Exactly. I love it.
No, really. I brought it for you.
No. Why don't you hold on to that?
I loved that the bleach blonde woman that we were being spoken to by, until the Yellow King spoke through her, every word that she said was a lie, beginning with the first two, my friends. Every single word was a lie. Beautiful.
And then an interesting question is, did she know she was even lying?
No.
And so for any of the three of you, was there any hurt or harm generated towards your fellow players in the course of this session?
Not really. Maybe towards the queen. But I'm not sure I got much towards the other players in this session.
No.
Okay.
I think Kiara could have a point of help towards either Hope or Boudelon, in the sense of, with Hope, I saw like the kind of acknowledging of their kind of comfortable chemistry, even though there's sort of that sort of long-suffering yet good-humored tension between them. And also I liked King of Boudelon asking, I think that question, I think helped Kiara get to like, oh, this might not be what we think it is. This is not going to be like a thing where we just go in and fight the monster and win. You know? So I could see it either way. I think so can we use our help and hurt from in our past forms for future? So like I have help points for Claiborne. Could I use that for Hope?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. In that case, I have two, so I think I'll give this one to Hope. If that makes sense.
I like that you got a sense of help for Hope. That seems in keeping with the sun.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you all for being so excellently present for this delicious episode of Marriage of Serpents, wherever it is that we're going with this wacky story. And I look forward to seeing you next episode, and I hope you all join us.
Thank you very much. Good session. Great.